Good evening, 7 o'clock. Great to be with you. The end of a Sunday. For those of you who are new here to 7 o'clock, you'll see a text mobile phone number on the screen as we go. And you're welcome to text in questions that may arise as we go through the sermon, and we'll have a go at answering some of those, time permitting, at the end. I think it's fair to say that the end focuses your game plan now. And I think that's true in all walks of life. The end focuses your game plan now. So we see it with exams. If you know exams are coming up for you at the end of the year, at the end of the semester for your university course, your TAFE course, your high school certificate, whatever it may be, then that end will focus your time now. That will make you focus your time in ways that you otherwise wouldn't. You'll be reading stuff that you might not otherwise read. You'll have to say no to movies and hanging out when you'd like to do that because you're focused on the end that is coming. If you're involved in a sporting team, say for instance a rugby league team, and the grand final is coming up, that will focus your team and the way it trains. There'll be extra training, there'll be extra focus on the opponents that you'll be facing and strategies in order to win that goal. That's the only photo I could find. The last photo of Parramatta winning the grand final is actually in black and white. That says a little bit on it by itself. Or take, for instance, the momentous news that we heard tonight. Another end that can shape your game plan now is a wedding date. Now, I might want to say that getting married is the end, Chris and Amy. That's kind of a bleak view. Although it is the end in some ways, because it's the end of your engagement. It's the end of that period of your being together and the beginning of a new period. And that end will focus Chris and Amy's time in all sorts of weird ways that they may never do again. They'll be looking at cakes and dresses and garters and veils and shoes, and Amy will probably be looking at that stuff as well. Or just this week, I heard there's a crew going, it's a wonderful story actually, a group of people who've been involved with fundraising for the Children's Hospital at Westmead for a new unit there, a new cerebral palsy unit. They are going to climb Mount Kilimanjaro with the son of Sir Edmund Hillary, the first man to climb Mount Everest. He is taking them on an expedition up the mountain as a kind of thank you for all their fundraising work. They've raised $1 million. And as I heard this interview, as I heard him interviewed and talking about the crew that as they're going to walk up, they said, look, are the people doing anything now? Has it changed what they're doing? He said, oh yes. They are on strict exercise regimes. They're on strict diets to get their bodies into shape to survive the climb and so they can achieve the end that is in view. Now, we are in a series on 2 Timothy. We're coming to the end next week as the last sermon in this series. And of course, this is Paul's last letter that we have available to us that has survived. And Paul writes to his young charge, Timothy, his ministry apprentice. And in the passage that we heard tonight, Paul is staring right at the end. The cold, unblinking, stony gaze of death is looking straight back at him. He is facing death in the very near future as he pens these words. And so he says there in verse 6 of 2 Timothy chapter 4, "For I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time has come for my departure. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith." These are last words. But look at the confidence that he has as he faces the end of ends. Verse 8, "Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day." The crown of righteousness awarded by the judge of heaven and earth. Now, it's easy for us to kind of just slide over those words. We think, oh, sure, okay, that's fine, because that's for Paul, who was an apostle. He was one of the super ones in the early church. He was anointed and appointed by God to go and preach all about Jesus to the Gentile world. Of course, someone like that with that sort of role is going to get a special honor in God's kingdom. That makes sense. We've got to stop and think for a moment what this means. You see, Paul was one of the most despised, evil men that the early church knew for a time. He was a Christian killer, and not just by accident. He was the head of the Christian killers. He was the leader of the posse. He was the one who organized it and sent them out to kill the other Christians. And this man can face death, look it straight on, with no guilt, with no fear, and say, there awaits for me the crown of righteousness. Not just sliding into the back of heaven somewhere, hoping that he won't get noticed and he'll just enjoy this little back corner of heaven. He will be front and center, and Jesus, the Lord of heaven and earth, will put the crown of righteousness on his head and say, well done, good and faithful servant. That is an incredible statement of confidence, is it not? That is an incredible statement of confidence in the grace of God to forgive him for his sin and to restore him to a place of right relationship with the God who made him. But then he says something amazing. There is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. What's he saying? He's saying everyone can face their end just like this. No guilt, no fear, with complete confidence that the crown of righteousness can be placed on their head in front of heaven and earth by the judge of all heaven and earth. This sort of confidence in the face of death is open to anyone, says Paul. And what's the key? For all who have longed for his appearing. For all those who are walking with Jesus, who have their hope in Jesus, they are the ones who can be confident of the crown. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, what's all this talk about confidence at the end? Like the guy's, you know, he's facing death, but that's such a long way off for people here, for people like us. You look at us, we're in the prime of life. What are you talking about the end for? The end is such a long way off, isn't it? Do you know that? Recently, Matt Chandler was diagnosed with cancer. You may or may not know Matt Chandler. He's a pastor in the United States. He pastors a church of about 5,000 or so called the Village Church. He was out in Australia last year. Marty and Mike and a couple of others went to hear him speak. He's a very popular podcaster, great preacher, a great guy, doing wonderful things for the gospel in his area in the States. He's in his 30s with young kids. He's probably a fraction younger than me. He made me shiver, this story. But he was interviewed recently about his experience going through cancer and having an operation and some of the treatment. And he said this. Lauren, his wife, asked the doctor, what's the best case scenario and the worst case scenario? And the doctor said, well, the best case scenario is that God heals you, and that's what we're hoping for. The worst case scenario, honestly, is that you'll get killed in a car wreck on your way home today. He was the first one to say to me out loud, look, nothing's really changed for you. You just get to be aware that you're mortal. Everyone is, but they're just not aware of it. The gift that God's given you is that you get to be aware of your mortality. So, says Matt, if this goes bad for me, if my next MRI scan shows that I've got a short amount of time, I can talk to my wife, talk to my children, shoot videos. Most guys who die in their 30s kiss their wife goodbye in the morning and never come home. At least once a year, for the rest of my life, I get the anxiety of, am I going to hear today that I only have a couple of years to live? It's a gift. How long do you have? The end focuses your game plan now. There will come an end for each one of us. There will come an end for each of those that we love. We might have a fair idea of where it's coming, like the Apostle Paul did. He could see it pretty large on his horizon. Or you might have no idea. But it will come. So what should we do in the light of that great truth? How should the promise of the crown of righteousness held out to us at the end, how should that shape what we do now? Because there's no doubt that that end should shape what we do now. As Paul begins to wrap up this letter, as we turn to chapter 4, he wants Timothy to have the end in mind when thinking about the rest of his life. And so see what he says in chapter 4, verse 1. In the presence of God and of Christ, the Messiah, Jesus, who will judge the living and the dead, and in view of his appearing and his kingdom, I give you this charge. In view of the end, in view of the judgment that is coming by the judge, the Lord Jesus, in view of the appearing of his kingdom, I give you this charge. In other words, Timothy and generations who will come after Timothy, Jesus will judge the living and the dead. The actions that you do in the body in this life, they do mean something. We will be held accountable for what we do and we don't do. And so, what do we do? In the presence of that judge who is here with us and in light of his coming again, how do we make sure that we and others can face the end with confidence like Paul does? Knowing that that crown of righteousness can be ours. What do we do? Paul says three things in this passage. Three things. Number one, show the path. Show the path. Verse 2, in the view of the coming kingdom, in view of the end, preach the word. Be prepared in season and out of season. See, in a sense, there's nothing more that needs to be done to reach the summit of the mountain of this life and to claim that crown of victory, to have it as your own, to be wearing it in God's presence forever. There's nothing more to be done because Jesus' death for sins and his resurrection to life means that it is finished. The work that needs to be done to claim that crown is finished. It is finished by Jesus in our place. Nothing more to be done. No secret formula to learn. Nothing you've got to memorize. We need to remember and be reminded time and time again, the gospel is not like any other religion. The gospel does not give us advice. It does not say, here is the end, here is the crown of righteousness. If you want to get that, make sure, tick this, tick this, tick this, tick this, pray this many times, turn up this to this thing, say this, memorize this. It doesn't give advice. The gospel gives news. It's finished. Everything you've got to do, all the boxes you can imagine you've got to tick, Jesus has ticked them. It's finished. And so we are called to be heralds of the news. The herald was the one who turned up to the village, to the town, to the city, to announce what had happened. The herald didn't come with advice. The herald turned up to deliver news. And that is what we're called to do. That's all that this word means, to preach in this passage. You might see that and it says, preach the word, and think, okay, well, that applies to about three people in this building, because they're the only ones who are going to get up and preach a sermon on the platform. But the word there just means be a herald. In other words, say, look, here's the path. Here's the path between here and the crown of righteousness at the end. The path has been laid out. You don't have to put any more paving stones down. It stretches all the way from here to eternity. Here is the path. Look how it stretches to the prize. And we are called to speak these words of truth that God has given to us in the Bible, in all of our contexts that we find ourselves, big or small. And there'll be some times when that's really easy to do. With good friends, over a coffee and a pizza, for other people you know who walk with the Lord Jesus daily, that's going to be really easy. What did you think of the sermon on Sunday night? I was reading this in my devotions this week. We talked about this in small group. I've been thinking about this idea. What do you think about that? It's going to be easy with your D team or your Bible study group, people that who know and trust each other. It's going to be easy to talk about that with a mentor or someone that you are mentoring as someone who's a little bit further along the path. And so we've got to speak these words of truth to each other when it's easy. Preach the word in season. But we've also got to be heralds. We've got to be speakers of this truth to each other when it's not so easy. Like with your friend who is struggling with that particular sin. And they've spoken to you lots of times before. And you know, if they come and tell you they've fallen again, that conversation's not going to be right. You're not going to be able to say, that's okay, whatever you're doing, it doesn't really matter. It does matter. So that's not going to be easy. Or like with friends who aren't regular here or may turn up once in a while. That's not going to be easy. Or with a boyfriend or a girlfriend who has other things on their mind, or with a wife or a husband who you think is just letting the gospel priorities go out of your relationship with work or with your time or with your kids. But we've got to speak the truth and keep showing the path out of season as well. Which leads to the second point. The second thing. First point is show the path. Preach the word in season and out of season. Show the path that has been laid out, the fact that it is finished, and we just walk on it. But secondly, Paul says to Timothy and to us, keep people on the path. Keep people on the path. This is what Paul says to Timothy next, in view of the end that is coming and the fact that those who get to the end with their hope in Jesus will get the crown. What else do we do? He says, correct, rebuke, and encourage with great patience and careful instruction. Now, encourage, we can probably warm to straight away. That one's pretty easy. I think most people will think, I want to go to church on Sunday, I want to be encouraged. I want to go to church on Sunday, and chances are I've got it in me to encourage someone else. That's going to be pretty easy to do. If I see someone, they do a good job, I'm going to say, well done. That's easy. But not many people like to be rebuked or corrected. I mean, you may just saying those words may have sent shivers down your spine to be involved in that experience. Conjures up some images of a school teacher type, some know-it-all who's going to come and give you the double barrel godliness talk and just offload in you. But notice two things here. That way of going about it is not how Paul tells Timothy to go about it. He says, correct, rebuke, and encourage with great patience and careful instruction. If there's someone you know who looks like they might be falling off the path, not living with Jesus as their Lord, not walking in the path of grace, but going back to old patterns of slavery, not walking in a path of freedom, but going back to captivity and bondage to Satan. You don't give it to them both barrels. You walk alongside. You say, can I open a Bible with you? Can I talk to you? Can I listen? Can we talk about it? Can I point you to the scriptures gently? Because I want you to come back onto this path. You know where the path leads. Paul says do it with patience and careful instructions. But second, the consequences of falling off this path are just disastrous. See, there's no other way to the crown of righteousness. There is no other way to safely navigate the end that is facing each one of us than to keep walking on the path that is laid out by Jesus. And we shouldn't think that people falling off the path is some sort of abstract threat. See what Paul says in verse 3. For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. This was true in Timothy's day, and it's true in ours as well. I'll never forget, I was just out of Moore College, green and mean, ready to do gospel ministry, you know, armed with 4 years of kind of knowledge and exams. Like, let's take this thing out for a test drive and put it into action, all this stuff. So I started, you know, a few months into my new church, I started meeting up with a guy, thinking, great, this guy's really keen. He wants to get involved in leadership. He wants to meet up with you. That's great. We started meeting up and we started chatting about ministry. It was fantastic. It was great. And then pretty suddenly, after about 2 months, after about four meetings, he said he didn't want to meet up with me anymore, which surprised me because it normally takes people a little bit longer to be worn down by my particular type of sense of humour. 6 months, pretty reasonable. 2 months, a bit early. I've still got material to deliver here. But he said, no, he didn't want to meet up with me anymore. And turns out that he had met someone in the context of university campus ministry, someone on the university campus who had found him and had told him that he had been called to become a special priest. I asked him what that meant. He didn't really know either, but it sounded good and he wanted to do it. He had to get rid of all Bibles and just read a King James Version Bible.